All right, we're back again.
Hello, everybody.
This is Al.
And Don.
And we're going to talk about more artists.
One thing Al and I were just talking about, which always threw me, was underrated artists. To me, the ones we're going to talk about, they're always some of my favorites. The first one I want to talk about is Jim Aparo. Jim Aparo, I discovered him. He drew out Batman, the Brave and the Bold. There was always Batman and another guest. I couldn't wait every month to get one to see how he draw certain characters. There was nothing that he couldn't draw, and it was always smooth and slick. I liked the style. Again, he was one I always found. He also did Adventure Comics in the 70s. Al and I are both fans of the Michael Fleischer written Spectre stories he did. He also drew Aquaman, the ones that I knew. The only reason I even put him in this category was, I think in 1984, I was reading a Comic Scene magazine, and they said the next issue we're going to have an interview with Jim Aparo, and everybody can learn about this completely underrated artist. Well, to me, he was always, you know, one of my top artists, so I was always surprised. There's a whole list of the people that people consider underrated.
Oh, yeah, there's tons of them. But, yeah, Aparo was definitely like a guy that he did a lot of work. I mean, I first saw him, I think it was the Charlton Phantoms. I'm not sure if it was the Charlton Phantoms that he did or the Brave and the Bold that he did. But oh, and the Aquaman, too.
Yeah, the Aquaman, he was doing in, I think, 78.
Yeah, he took over after from Nick Carty, I think.
Yeah, those are wonderful, too. Aquaman was always one of my favorites. And I'll tell you, I loved every artist that's famous that's done him. I loved Ramona Freyden, I loved Nick Carty, and I loved Jim Aparo. They all just pulled it off, even though they're pretty much completely different artists.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah, Aparo had like a nice... At first, it was almost like kind of like Neil Adamsy a little bit, to me anyway, you know, but with a different look to it. But you know, the thing about Aparo, too, is I think he did the lettering as well, so he was like a one-man show.
I never knew that, but I'm not surprised, because it always had a feel. His work was always kind of narrow and angular in a way, but it always looked right. Again, the thing that threw me with him, sometimes certain artists, they stay away from things, like they don't draw cars, you know, they don't draw things that they're not good at, animals, kids. But when Jim Aparo did it, everything was flawless. I loved how he set up his pages. He liked to use a lot of narrow panels. He'd draw things angular and skinny. But it didn't matter what it was. It looked like it should have been there. It always had a feel. And, yeah, the lettering was just this strong. They were easy to read. I want to say, if he didn't work in the superhero comic industry, he would have been one of those we talked about that could have been an adult romance, you know, a drama type. Some of the things like, what was that, John Fury that Alex Toth did? It could have been along the same lines of it.
He did, I think he did the Phantom Stranger too, which was nice.
Yeah, I think he co-created
very early ones, yeah, very early ones.
Yeah, and again, just staggering work. He never
stopped.
Tons
of covers too.
But the Brave and the Bold, that's the one I couldn't wait to get all the time. I couldn't wait to see how he drew people. And there were certain characters like Richard Dragon, I think they're calling them
Kung Fu Fighter.
I never liked the character, but when he was in The Brave and Bold, I thought, man, this is genius. So,
I think there was some Kung Fu Fighter that was, I think it was penciled by Rick Estrada and inked by Wally Wood. And, you know, that's like, you know, when Wood got a hold of it, it was like, you know, pure Wally Wood. I remember liking that one.
Well, the first issue of Kung Fu Fighter to go on that one, we all bought it. This was in 74 when Bruce Lee was the god and David Carradine was on the Kung Fu TV show and Shang-Chi from Marvel was, you know, you couldn't get enough Kung Fu. So DC put that out and I bought the first issue and I was like, this is in 74 and this guy's walking around with the crew cut and he keeps calling everybody, you cats. He sounded like Sammy Davis Jr. And I thought, what kind of comic is this? I didn't care for the art, but it would have been all right. It's just that it just seemed like nobody could figure out what the timeline was and what the guy was about. I guess they had the second issue, the art team changed or something.
They were
trying to make the character look a little different. I think Jim Starlin did some of that.
He might have. Yeah, that sounds familiar. Yeah, I just remember that, and I remember the other one that Marvel had, Master of Kung Fu with Paul Gillespie.
Yeah, Shang-Chi.
Starlin did Master of Kung Fu.
Yeah, but I think he did a cover or something for Kung Fu Fighter.
He might have, yeah.
But yeah, he was behind Shang-Chi somehow.
He did. He did the first couple, and I think after that, Gillespie did his Histarenko homage. You know, I love Gillespie, though, so that's not a put down.
No, they were really popular comics.
But yeah, Perro was like, he was penciling, inking it, lettering it for a while. I mean, for years and years and years. He did tons of Brave and the Bold. He did like a good chunk of Aquaman, too. I'd say like about 30 issues or something like that right after Carty left.
Yeah, they were really strong issues. What was your favorite work Jim Aparo did?
Oh, the Spectre.
Yeah, me too.
Those are crazy stories.
For those that aren't aware of the Spectre was one of the Golden Age heroes that DC had. Jerry Siegel, the creator and writer of Superman, created the Spectre with another artist.
Bernard Bailey, maybe?
It might have been. But it didn't do well in the Golden Age, I guess. It wasn't the big hit Superman was. He was basically, wasn't he a cop that was murdered and came back to avenge?
Yeah.
He was an avenging spirit.
Yeah, that's it.
And I'd see he was in the Justice Society of America with, you know, Hourman and Hawkman and, you know, Dr. Fate and all the other Golden Age characters. I thought he was pretty neat. I mean, I liked the old reprints. Yeah, it was Bernard Bailey.
I remember it was,
old reprints that have his name on it.
The reprints, yeah. When DC used to do the reprints in the back, they used to have the Golden Age.
I love those, man.
Oh, man. Yeah, when I see Bernard Bailey, that's a name that comes to mind anyway.
It was him. But it was a nice character. I liked him. But then all of a sudden, in like 1973, Adventure Comics, they put Weird above the Adventure Comics logo.
I forgot about that.
Because they had Weird War Tells, so they had Weird funny. Adventure, and the Spectre was the main character. And I couldn't believe it. They were completely different, and basically, the whole story would start out, which DC made an animated short of that. I'll bring it in for you.
I didn't know that.
In the DC animated short, they have music in the background. It sounds like an old porno soundtrack from the 70s. But it's they basically took these Michael Fleischer, Jim Aparo Spectre stories and made a short out of it. But it always started out with the crime of something that was going to happen. And then Jim Corrigan, who was the Spectre, would show up as a policeman. He'd investigate it. And then as the thing would unfold, the Spectre would come out. And I remember he turned one of the criminals into wood and then ran him through a saw blade, you know.
Oh, those were great. I remember that.
You know, I was 11 years old reading these. I'm like, my God, what? My friends ate it up. We all had different issues, but he was an avenging spirit. And they were really dark, but...
They were humorous at the same time.
Yeah, they were humorous, but I mean, like I said... It wouldn't have worked if Jim Aparo hadn't been the artist.
That's right. Jim Aparo made it look great.
And I never had this, and my friend had one of those Brave and the Bold. I think it was a 100-issue Super Spectacular, 100-page Super Spectacular. But it was Batman and the Spectre was the lead story. And the thing that got me, there was a few scenes where the two of them are walking together down a alleyway. And just how the capes for the two characters were moving and flowing with them. And I thought, wow, you know, again, I think by this time I was 12 or 13. And I just thought, how is this guy doing this? You know, I think about it, you know, Avenging Spirit and a guy dressed like a bat walking down an alleyway talking could be dorky, but
the way if Jim Aparo did it.
No, when Jim Aparo did it, it was just awesome.
Yeah, he's definitely not considered one of the top guys anymore, but he was another working guy that he did a lot of meat and potatoes kind of stories, like real good runs of books or whatever, but they were always very nicely done.
They were nicely done. And the covers he did, one of my favorites, which I think I will post on the blog when this comes up, it was Batman and Wonder Woman. And there was tigers jumping on the, I think they were fighting Catwoman, but there was two tigers on the cover. But he drew even animals. When he drew animals, you'd think the guy was an animal artist because they looked right.
Right.
You know, like, again, I can't stress this. Everybody has a limitation. But you read some superhero comic books, there's no cars, you know, because cars are hard to draw. sometimes people don't like to draw kids. I remember Chris Claremont was talking about how much he enjoyed working with Alan Davis, because he says there wasn't any time Alan Davis ever said, "I can't draw that." He could write anything in the strip, and, you know, Alan Davis would put it in. Well, Jim Aparo was one of them. Animals, kids, adults, old people, automobiles, buildings, spaceships, he could do it all.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I seen it, when you mentioned spaceships, I remember I have somewhere some strange suspense stories that Charlton did, and he did some sci-fi stories for them that were real nice.
I've only seen the DC work. And you mentioned you think he did
Phantom.
The Phantom?
No, yeah, he definitely did the Phantom. And I remember the strange suspense stories that were like sci-fi and mystery stories that he did. So I think he started out, if I remember correctly, because I didn't really research him that much. He was an advertising guy that got into comics. I think he got into Charlton.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure. You know, I've heard stories that back in the early 60s, before Neil Adams got in, that Marvel and DC was a closed shop. They weren't really, like, hiring people. So I guess people like Aparo and Pat Boyette and Don Newton, Tom Sutton, people like that, got in through Charlton Comics. They were the ones who were giving people a shot. Not 100% sure, though, but I'm thinking that's what was happening.
Well, Dick Giordano came from there as well.
Dick Giordano was a Charlton artist, yeah.
Well, and also, I think he was an editor-in-chief or publisher there.
Yeah, and he did that Sarge Steel.
I've never seen any of his work at Charlton either.
You never seen Giordano towards the middle 60s? It was real nice. It was just as good as the DC stuff he did. He did Sarge Steel. He did a lot of romance books. He inked people like he always did, you know, really well. Oh, yeah, definitely. I never seen him. I'll find some books I have of his.
Yeah, well, I've been told he worked. I've read about it, but I've never seen it.
Ditko did a lot of work for Charlton, too, around that time.
Yeah, I've seen that, his Blue Beetle work and The Question and all that stuff. And he used to do Dr. Graves, that horror book.
Yeah, the Ghostly...
Ghostly Haunts of Dr.
Graves. That's it. Oh, my God, those rule. Yeah, those are great, yeah. You know what I found the other day? I'd never seen this before, a romance story that Ditko did. I'll pull it out and show it to you. I mean, it's like, I'd never seen that before. I've seen Ditko do almost every. I've seen him do war books, but I've never seen him do a romance book. And he definitely did one for Charlton, I think, in the early 70s. Now, when he was doing Spider-Man, maybe you know this, when he was working for Marvel doing Spider-Man, was he doing the Charlton? I guess he was doing the Charlton work at the same time, right?
I see, the Charlton work he did, I just found out past tense.
Okay.
There was a company, he used to go to Walgreens Drugs. I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I walked into Walgreens Drugs, and they had those packets, three comic books in a bag. And they said Modern Comics. I said, what's Modern Comics? Well, I guess it's some kind of imprint of Charlton. I bought these in, I think, 78.
Yes, I remember. They were reprints of the early ones, yeah.
But they weren't sold like in 7-Elevens or anything. They were sold in these bags, and they were sold, like, I only saw them at Walgreens. And but that's where I saw the Blue Beetle, you know, the Ted Kord Blue Beetle. I'd always heard of it, and also The Question and Captain Atom.
Yeah.
I got several of those while I was there. They also had some Marvels. I remember I got a couple of Marvel team-ups that John Byrne and Chris Claremont did.
In bags?
Yeah, in the bags, but it said, I think it said Modern Comics as well. I'm not sure.
I'll tell you a story about those bag comics. This is going back before that. It was probably like in the what I used to do back in the, I guess it was in the late 60s. I don't know if those food chains are around anymore. Do you remember A&P?
Yeah, I think they're still around.
They're still around.
In
I don't know if there's
towns.
Any here, though, down here, but they're still around. Cool. But anyway, there was one near my house, and I remember they used to have bag comics. But the bag comics that they had was usually they would have like a tower comic, like one of those, Dynamo or No Man or the Thunder Agents. They would have one of those, and then they would have an Archie. And then I forgot what the third one was, but at that time I was really not into the Archie. I was going through one of my moods, so what I would do was I would see the back comics, tear it open, and grab all the Thunder Agents and put them in one bag or whatever. So I walk up and I get three Thunder Agents for, 25 cents or whatever, and I was like,
So they mixed the companies up in those
bags. I do remember ripping bags open and mixing and matching them to my
But see, when I saw these, this is like 71 and 72. Again, it was in the grocery stores, but it'd be a company, like it'd be DC. I don't remember Marvel. It was always DC or sometimes Charlton. But they were clear bags. The top would be printed, you know, in red and white ink. It'd say DC, three comics. I think it was 60 cents. Or, you know, it was cheaper than if you just bought them separately. But you could look on one side, there'd be one issue, you flip it over, there'd be another issue, and there'd be an issue in the middle that you had no idea what it was. And usually some comic I'd never touch. The way I'd get these is, sometimes I go down to Texas on the bus when I was a kid, and my mom would always pick one of those up just to occupy me on the bus. I remember one time she brought one, and it was Wonder Woman. I said, Wonder Woman? You know, as a kid I wouldn't read. He goes, honey, it's all they had. Oh, I read it. Okay, this isn't bad, you know. So, but yeah, I remember those. But that was the thing that used to irritate me on, was what was in the center. I think the last one I bought was one of my favorite ones. It was Batman. Neil Adams drew it. It was when the Joker came back, when they brought the Joker back, and they threw the guy in the wheelchair in the shark tank, and he had a red sweater.
I remember that.
They threw Batman in it. The other issue is still one of my favorites. It was Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. It's when Timberwolf came back. Dave Cockrum drew it. Just fantastic. And the third book was Shazam, I think number 4. And that was the first Shazam book I read. But to me, that was just a perfect 3. I didn't have to open the bag and take anything out and put anything in.
Yeah, I know. I was a bad kid. But hey, what can I tell you? You know, I was like, I wasn't into Archie at the time. I didn't know any better. Now I'd get in trouble for it. Back then, it's like, hey, you know, do I really want Archie or do I want, like, Thunder Agents? Right now I think I'll take Thunder Agents.
Yeah, it works. It works.
Hey, man, maybe we could, you want to play some music now, some Steve Robinson, maybe?
Yeah, this is another Steve Robinson, a friend of ours, and take it away.
All right.
Forget. Stands an empty shell, but the spirit is here. Don't you know it's all around? Precious, she was. Don't cry, because though it seems she went away, and you find hard to take. Don't you know she's still here? Don't you know she's all around?
Okay, we're back.
And that was Steve Robinson again. Hope you enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it.
But anyway, again, we're talking about underrated artists. Again, as we talk about this, none of these artists I ever felt was underrated to me. I was always surprised. The next ones I want to talk about, I was reading an interview with Howard Chaykin, again, one of my favorites. And he brought up that three of the most underrated artists that he thinks were some of the best comic book artists were Nick Carty, Ross Andrew, and Frank Thorne. Surprised me, because, again, I sought out anything these men drew.
Oh, yeah, all three of them are great.
Ross Andrew, I've always loved him. He was the first artist I saw drawing Spider-Man. When I started reading Spider-Man, I'd seen a few issues here and there that I guess John Romita drew. But when I started buying them and saving them, it was Ross Andrew. To me, to this day, he's still the Spider-Man artist that I always loved. He always had strong, solid figures. The way things moved, I couldn't say enough about him.
And the Spider-Man Doom Buggy.
Yeah. A friend of mine, we were on a band trip, and he said, "Are you going to bring your comic books?" Yeah, says me too. So the three of us, we brought, a little bag with our comic books in it. And he found out, like Spider-Man, he had two issues. One was where Aunt May married Dr. Octopus, and the other one was the introduction of the Spider Buggy, which I loved. And I remember he said he looked through mine and he wanted to trade me two issues for those. Okay. I don't remember what I traded, but I don't care. I love these issues. But I was always surprised whenever I'd buy old reprint books, I didn't know that he drew Wonder Woman. And fantastic.
Fantastic Wonder Woman. I think my first experience of Andrew was The Metal Men.
Yeah, and The Metal Men. That was I love The Metal Men. I thought they were great. And again, and it was always Mike Esposito was usually the
anchor
with him.
That was his Joe Sinnott.
Well, I've always been told that these two men, I think they were probably the longest running team in comics. They
sure, since the 50s. We were talking before, they did those soldiers and dinosaurs in the 50s. Those war stories, and those are fantastic.
Yeah, if you read Darwin Cook's New Frontier for DC, the series starts out with The Losers, which was fighting dinosaurs on an island. In the Losers comic series, that never happened. But in that one he did. I've never seen the comic. I just started seeing it on the internet. It was always Marines fighting dinosaurs. If I had seen it, I would have loved it.
Oh, man. Those are great. But The Metal Men, I just remember... This is one of those books that it's like the Challengers and the Doom Patrol for me back in the 60s. It was such a quirky book that I just kind of like loved it because I just remember like the one girl, Tina, she was always in love with the doctor or whatever, and it was just like funny to me. It was like, really, a robot? And then they had that other guy, Tin, who was always like a real wimpy guy or whatever. Oh, it was a great book.
And how they all took the characteristics, like Gold. To me, Gold always seemed kind of like Batman. He was all sure of himself.
Yeah.
He was a good guy. Iron, Iron was just the awesome tough guy that's so sure of himself. And Lead was like this tough, lovable buffoon,
Oh, man,
yeah. Yeah, they were... The thing that used to twist my 9-year-old mind, though, was they were robots, but they could stretch and change shapes. So how are they doing that,
I'm not sure who wrote those. Was that Arnold Drake? I'm not 100% sure. It seems like him, but I'm not. Maybe Bob Haney. I'll have to look it up.
For some reason, I want to say it was Robert Kaniger or Bob Haney.
Okay.
But I don't know.
We'll look it up and post it.
But they, the first time I saw him again was in one of these 100-page spectaculars. And I thought, this is the greatest comic I read. Well, they fought some giant green manta ray that flew in the air.
Yes.
And
remember the cover.
Yeah, they were... And when a little flying, like a convertible flying saucer, the Doc Magnus, the guy that created them, was using. And they realized what they had to do, so each Metal Man said goodbye, jumped off, and it covered this manta ray. And then I remember each one said, "It was nice knowing you, Doc," and they'd jump, and it seemed like it was killing Doc Magnus. And each one would spread themselves out to cover this thing. And when it was all finished, the thing hit the sea, and that was the end of the Metal Men. It was their introduction issue. What? And they had Doc Magnus put little tiny statues of them, and there's some Army colonel behind him, or Air Force colonel, I don't know what it was, but he said, "I'll never forget the Metal Men." And I says, "Well, of course you won't, because they ended up having their own magazine." I'm guessing that changed for the...
Yeah, they started off in Showcase, didn't they?
Yeah, I guess it was one of those issues where they said, "Well, what do you think?" And they brought them back. Again, fantastic work. Ross Andrew, like I said, he was, to me, he was always and always will be the Spider-Man artist. But I get these reprints. I says, "Man, this guy's here again." His Wonder Woman stuff, he was just solid. He could draw anything. It always was fun to read. It had its serious moments. It had its fun moments.
Yeah.
It was a serious yet lighthearted work. And I do know him and Mike Esposito, I guess, had a humor magazine at
one
time.
Yeah, I think
time.
It was called What? Back in the 50s. It was kind of like a Mad spinoff. They were reprinted a few years ago.
Well, they...
And they were really good, too. It was really good cartoon
and
humor
I think
artists.
They published that themselves, I'm
yes.
told.
Yeah, they did.
And they had a second magazine, which I've only read this on the internet, and it was the same thing. I guess they left one of the companies and tried to do it, and it didn't succeed.
They did romance work, too. I have some reprints of some romance stuff. I mean, they went on for, till I guess he moved to... When he moved to Marvel, I think Esposito worked with him, but I think he ended up working with... Well, he did the Spider-Man-Superman Treasury book, too. That was
Ross
Giordano.
Andrew. Yeah.
That was Ross Andrew and Giordano, yeah.
Yeah, DC and Marvel, they were always separate companies, but I was really surprised. I think this is 1975, into 74, beginning of 75. A friend of mine called me telling me that they were going to do a book together, and it was Wizard of Oz. And it was one of those oversized Treasury editions, and it was a DC Marvel publication. And I thought, okay, I never bought it. It looked kind of nice. Well, then it was, I guess a year later, they put out Superman vs. Spider-Man. Again, it was the large tabloid-sized format. And Ross Andrew was the artist. Dick Giordano was the inker. And Terry Austin.
Mm-hmm. He did backgrounds.
Yeah, he did the backgrounds. I guess he was an assistant to Dick Giordano. I want to say...
Wasn't he one of those crusty bunkers guys? All those guys that were in the studio with Neil Adams and Giordano and all those
yeah,
guys?
Yeah, he was. I know he was a continuity associate
with
Neil Adams.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But I'm trying to remember who wrote it. Was it Jerry Conway?
I think so.
But, again, they didn't have this book on the newsstands. They kept saying you could order it. And I never bothered ordering it. I never saw it in the newsstands. And even my friends are putting it down. So I'm going to read that. You know what's going to happen.
I could have sworn I saw it. I bought it at a supermarket.
Well, my cousin had it in his room. I said, "Where'd you get this?" He bought it at some convenience store.
Okay.
By this time, it was it was a year or two later. You remember back then, if you didn't get the comic when it was first out, you never see it again. And I read the thing, and man, that was just—it was breathtaking all the way around. The drawings and the story was great. The drawings were great, and it's also how they laid the thing out, just the arranging pages and how it was set up in chapters. And, it introduces Lex Luthor, and it introduces Dr. Octopus. And it shows what they were doing in town with giant robots or whatever trying to take over and rob banks. And then it introduced Spider-Man and Superman and how they stopped them. Then the two of them showed up in prison, got to be, a team. And it came out. And in between each chapter, it would have one page explaining Superman's origin. And it was just nicely drawn, nicely explained. It had a section with Spider-Man, showed how he came up with his web shooters and how he got bit by a radioactive spider. And it was always fun moments. I remember there was one where Spider-Man, I guess they were all reporters, so they met at some NASA expo thing with the space shuttle. And Spider-Man had a change, and he ran to find a phone book, and it was all the glass phone, displays like they showed in Superman, the movie.
Yeah, right.
And I thought, man, I was wishing so much I had bought it. I ended up buying it at some comic store in the 80s. They had a whole stack of them, and it was cover price. And
$1.
Man, yeah, I think it was $1.50, or it was $2. That's another reason I didn't buy it.
Okay.
But a friend of mine bought one. I said, "Where did you get this?" And he said, "Oh, that store you took me to." And there was two friends I went to college with in Texas, and they came up to see me in Oklahoma City. I took them to all the stores in town, and one of them bought it, and I said, where did you get this? So it was a store cover price. And the other guy said, that's one of the few books it was really worth, the old, you know, lives up to the oversized size. And I think, to me, that was my favorite Ross Andrew work, was the Superman-Spider-Man team-up.
That was definitely a nice one. I think I bought it out of 7-Eleven, now that you mentioned it. I also had a 7-Eleven, I think, a convenience store. I also got the Muhammad Ali and Superman, too. So those are always nice, those Treasury books.
I love those. I love the oversized. It was fun. I used to get them as birthday presents from people. You know, they weren't real expensive, and I saw Donald like his comics, and I absolutely loved them.
And it actually looked more like original art size.
Yeah, I think it was real close to that.
Almost, yeah. Oh, yeah, those were really good. I have a lot of them. I think the only one I don't have is the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I missed out on that one.
I had almost every one. When my wife and I moved so much, I got rid of a bunch of them. I saved maybe five. I bought a couple of them at the conventions when I saw them here and there.
Yeah,
they're fantastic.
Yeah, I remember Ross Andrew. His perspective was really interesting. He really worked a lot with. I seem to remember the buildings. He used to use like forced perspectives or whatever. And he was really good at it.
Yeah, he had. You know, you mentioned that he did have a really neat the angles he used.
Angular style. Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes just how the characters would bend and stuff. It looked right when he drew it, but if anybody else tried to do that, it would just be horrifying. You know.
I agree.
As a matter of fact, there's one thing I was telling you about. A lot of people don't know. I'd read it online. I've heard it, but then I read it online. Neil Adams was never credited for it, but he redrew Superman's face.
That's right.
On the Superman Spider-Man.
For free, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, because he didn't take credit, and I didn't believe it. And the one thing I was really surprised was how Ross Andrew pulled it off, because he was the Spider-Man artist, so it had that look. But the DC characters just looked right on the money. And, of course, you know, Dick Giordano inked it, and he was a good artist. But what blew my mind was there was a rumor that Neil Adams had penciled Superman's head in. And then Dick Giordano in an interview said, yeah, he did do that. He said nobody asked him to. He would just come over to Dick Giordano's desk, look at the pages, and the ones with Superman, he would just pick up and take and go home, and he re-penciled Superman's head.
He probably did that because I remember in the 60s, there were some covers of DC books. Like, I seem to remember one where Lois Lane gets married to Superman, and he drew the cover, but they would get either Al Plastino or somebody to draw the Superman face. So he's probably getting back.
Really?
Yes.
Well, you know, they did that to Jack Kirby when he did the new Jimmy Olsen, and they got Murphy Anderson to redraw the head.
A friend of mine had the original once, and I saw it. Yeah, it was really weird. I'd never noticed it when I was a kid buying it, but when he showed me the original, I was like, what? What's that? What's Jimmy Olsen and Superman's face being redrawn?
Well, you know, I never noticed that as a kid. And this is, I guess, in 97 or something. One of my buddies up in California, I went to see him, and I brought some of the issues of the new Jimmy Olsen I had, because he was a big Kirby collector. And he was going through them. I says, there was no reason they had to get Murphy Anderson to redraw Superman's head. What? And then I look, it's blatant. But blatant or not, I never noticed it.
No, I never did.
And before I gave them to my friend, I was in my 30s, you know, and I said, I thumbed through them. I said, man, these are really fun. I like these. You know, he would appreciate them more. But even then, I didn't notice that those were Murphy Anderson heads. And now they're just blatant as it could be, but I never noticed it.
Yeah, I know. Well, I guess Neil kind of got back at that by redrawing Ross's faces. I don't know.
Well, they said that he just felt it didn't look exactly like Superman, so he put them on. And Dick Giordano, when he confirmed it, he said when he did ink it, he tried to give them the odd shapes and everything, because I guess Ross Andrew drew his heads bigger on his characters than normal artists would. And he said he still tried to retain the Ross Andrew look and feel, you know, on those Neil Adams heads. So it wasn't blatant, and, you know, it looked nice, you know, but...
Yeah, and I think the last... Ross Andrew worked for a while. I actually remember him doing work for those Skywald books, those horror books that were kind of like creepy imitators or whatever, and he did some work for him too with Mike Esposito and Washes. That they're not the best, but it was still, and you could tell it was Ross Andrew.
I never knew that.
Yeah, show him to you. Yeah, he did that, and then actually Bill Everett actually did some work for those guys towards the end of his career too, like in the 70s. I know Ross Andrew went on and did more stuff, but that was the. I just remember those because those were odd. It was odd to see him doing like these horror books along with like the Spanish artists, and I think even like Tom Sutton did some work. But it made sense that Tom Sutton would be working for the horror books too. But yeah, well, I'll show them to you. Skywald,
Yeah, like I said, Ross Andrew, he did a lot of really nice series that are top series, and really strong work. I've always loved it. I don't know why anybody ever think he was underrated, because to me he was just right up at the top. And
we were all like going crazy over Neil Adams and all those guys, you know, Kirby and all those.
I like them too, but I always bought Ross Andrew. It was nothing but good thoughts and love to Ross Andrew. I never forgot him. So,
Ross Andrew, you rule. Hey, how about Nick Carty?
Well, that was another one that Howard Chaykin mentioned. Is he felt as one of the greatest cartoonists and underrated. I love Nick Carty. I bought the Teen Titans because Nick Carty drew them. Mm-hmm. Aquaman, he was slick, and I loved a lot of the covers he did. And one thing you could always tell on Nick Carty was when he did Batman on the covers, he had these strange inverted ears. It kind of made like an oval.
That's right.
And but his figures were solid, they were smooth, and they were always happy.
Yeah, I love those Teen Titans and Batlash. Batlash is a great.
That's story. Right. I think he co-created Batlash
with Sergio Aragonés.
Yeah, those are great stories. My daughter is a big Conan O'Brien fan, and she came down from college, and they had Bruce Timm on the Conan O'Brien show. They talked about DC animation, and since he's part of Warner Brothers, so he went over there and gave you a tour of the studio, and then he had Bruce Timm on the show. And Bruce Timm drew Conan O'Brien as a superhero. And it was funny, and I was really surprised he pulled it off, because Conan O'Brien had him draw him with, like, fishnet stockings, golf shoes, with the little fringes over the laces. Just basically any bad thing you could put on it, and it looked fantastic. You can see it on the Internet. You can see the whole clip on YouTube. You can see the Bruce Tim drawing of Conan. It was just strong. He did it in color in front of everybody. And my daughter was showing it to me. I says, I just can't believe he pulled off that awful character. And my daughter said, well, Dad, it's Bruce Tim. Well, I'm going to agree with that. But then, after he did all that, Conan started pulling out some of these characters and said, explain to this. They were DC characters. I don't remember the other two, but one was Batlash. And they said, explain it. It's a cowboy dandy?
Yeah.
And he was kind of, and when he said it, you're thinking, yeah, that it just sounds awful. And then my daughter said, Dad, are those real characters? I said, well, yeah, Batlash. I didn't know the other two. But she goes, ooh. And I said, no, not ooh. Batlash was a fantastic character. The stories were fun. They were great fun. And he was just unique. And I remember, one of my favorite Nick Carty covers was Batlash, and they're holding a black and white photo. It was the Wild West. It had a pair of lips, like some lady kissed it, and somebody's burning a hole through it, and you can see them, behind it. Oh, that's genius. And Batlash, they were great stories. He was a great character. And I think Sergio Aragonés left. He didn't do some of the later ones.
Right, yeah, no, I forgot who took over after that, but they were still drawn by Nick Carty, so they were still great or whatever, so.
Well, I've seen some of them, but what I didn't like about those was they were too slapstick, kind of sophomoric. And Sergio Aragonés, he explained that what happened was he came up with the ideas, and he would kind of lay them out, in a real sketchy way. And then I guess somebody else would go through and polish the stories up, and then Nick Carty would draw them.
Oh, yeah.
And when Sergio Aragonés left, again, it was always like, pratfalls and, stuff like that.
And I just pulled out my Nick Carty book here. And wow, he's been around since the 40s, man. I forgot about all this stuff that he did. He's doing Tarzan stories here. He's doing like all. This guy's awesome. Okay, doing like romance stories. He's doing like Tomahawk. He's doing like.
I didn't know he did Tomahawk.
Yeah, check it out, man. And movie posters too. He really is an extremely underrated artist because by the time of the mid 70s, I think all he was doing was covers.
Yeah.
For DC, he was doing almost like every cover, you know. So.
But I love those. You know, the thing Al and I always talk all the time was certain cartoonists would make you want to draw, and he was one of them. And
he had a nice loose style too.
Yeah.
It wasn't like overly like you know. The line work was just right. It was just like, you know, just do as little as possible, almost Toth-ish in a way. Maybe not as design-oriented, but, you know, just like simplicity.
Yeah, it was simple, and I want to say soft. The figures were solid, but they were soft, and it just, even if the character was serious, it just looked happy. You know, I can't stress that enough. I used to always buy, like I said, the Teen Titans, the Aquaman stuff. But I love the covers. I'm not a big fan of comic books that have covers done by another artist in the interior. But a lot of times he would do them. They'd be for these oversized reprints of the 100-page super spectaculars, and they were just wonderful.
I mean, he was doing, like, almost every other cover I remember. It's like all the mystery books had covers by Cardi in them.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the Batman, like you said, the giant size ones that Cardi covers in them, yeah.
Well, the Batlash stories. He did a lot of Superman. I didn't realize he did these Superman covers and looking through for Action Comics.
Sure.
The one with the dentist.
Yeah. I love those. The guy's amazing.
We have a, there's a friend of mine at work, I mentioned Melody Johnson. She would go to MegaCon every year, and I really appreciated the fact, she says, she'd hand me a brochure, and she said, here's the people going to be there, look through it. If there's anybody you want to sign, give me the books. And I looked through it, and one year Nick Carty was there. And I have one issue of Aquaman that I still, you know, it's not falling apart, it's in good shape. So I gave that to her and explained it's Nick Carty. She wrote it down. She says, okay, I'll get it signed. She came back, and she says, oh my, what a sweet, sweet man. And she was so delighted. And she said they went there, and he had a book of, I guess, all the covers and stuff he did. And she said when he went in there, he was, she pulled it out for him to sign, and he was so delighted. And he's telling all of his friends around him, hey, look, this is one of the covers I did. And she said one of her friends that came to the convention with her, he was so enamored by him that he started collecting his work. They started buying the Teen Titans and other stuff. And I remember the next year she went to MegaCon. She was excited to find out Nick Carty was there because she wanted to see him again. I guess he lived in Florida.
He lives in Sarasota, I think.
Oh, but like I said, as I've said before, if it's an artist you like or a writer, any person that you like their work, you'd like to think that they're nice people. And I never got to meet him, but
he's still alive. Still have a chance.
My friend, she just couldn't stop going on, and I, you know, she did me a huge favor. But the way she acted was like I did her a favor by having her get this book signed so she can meet him. So, Nick Carty, you're never underrated with me, and I don't know why anybody would even think that.
Yeah, I saw him at like in 2006. I went to Heroes Con in North Carolina, and he was there. Didn't get a chance to talk to him, but I saw him drawing, and I saw George Tuska, too. Yeah, he was very nice, too. And Carty was doing beautiful sketches there. I mean, he was charging $150, but you're getting, like, some beautiful work. My friend got a Black Canary drawing by him. I mean, Carty draws, like, awesome-looking women. So, you know, he got a Black Canary, and it was wonderful. And I saw him, like you said, talking to the people, and he was always very nice and very genial to everybody.
Well, you know, that's the thing I mentioned. His work was always happy and genial, just like you said, so I could see where he'd be the same way.
Now, some of these horror covers look a little, you know, they don't look too happy here, but most of the superheroes were into it or whatever, so.
Well, he was a professional artist, so he could do what needed to be done. But, yeah, I was surprised when Howard Chaykin said that, not that he was one of the tops, so just the fact that people underrated him, because, again, I never did.
So how about that Frank Thorne, Mr. Red Sonja?
Frank Thorne. I always knew the Red Sonja from the Conan books, and Al and I both liked John Buscema's Conan. And at one point, I think it was a Marvel feature, it said Red Sonja was in it. I think the first issue they did of that, Dick Giordano did one story, and Esteban Moroto did another one, and they were quite nice. Then after that, I guess the second issue is Frank Thorne, and he was another one. It said Art and Colors by Frank Thorne, and he did the lettering as well. And like Jim Aparo, his lettering had a character to it that just fit the artwork. He drew Red Sonja a little differently. She was simpler with really, really heavy eye lines. Kind of a graphic look, but very playful, almost like an elf type creature. Red Sonja is a character that wore a steel bikini, which made sense when you were a kid for some odd reason. But it just had a light hardness to it. He drew the most horrifying bugs and giant monsters that she had to fight, spider webs. It always had a grossness to it as well. But I bought every issue of these Marvel books she did. She ended up having her own series, and it was more of a fantasy-based piece. I had several when I was in high school, and I remember when I was in college, I went to a convention, and I sought them out. I got every issue he did. My favorite part to Frank Thorne was his design, how he laid pages out. There was, I guess, the second issue of Red Sonja. It was called Maze. And just that one page, it had kind of a splash page or something on the side, I guess her eyes looking over. And then the way he lettered the title letter in the Maze, just to this day, it's just some of my favorite, strongest work.
I remember him doing a book for Gold Key called Mighty Samson.
I've seen those on the internet. I never read them, but I've seen them on the internet.
Those were very nice, too. And that was like in the 60s. So, and he had his style was a little tighter then, but it was still, you could tell it was Frank Thorne. I mean, at least I could. And then I seem to remember him doing a Western for DC, maybe Tomahawk.
I think it was Tomahawk.
And I got a feeling he did some war stuff, too. When I was a kid, he reminded me a little bit of Kubert. I don't know why. Maybe the looseness, I don't know, but he reminded me a little bit of him.
Well, you know, that's something, and when I say this, I know I'm going to be a laughingstock, but when I was a kid, I couldn't tell the difference between Joe Kubert and Nestor Redondo.
Well,
now I see it, and it's a big difference.
Yeah.
But Frank Thorne was another one, like you mentioned Joe Kubert. I thought the same thing. Didn't Frank Thorne do Korak?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he did Korak. And see, I thought, my God, how many books can Joe Kubert do?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was doing all those war books, and he was doing Tarzan.
And then Korak. Why didn't he do the whole DC universe?
Yeah, well, I mean, it seemed like he was, you know. And I didn't realize that Frank Thorne was the one doing Korak.
That's right.
But I remember the Tomahawk. I seen a couple of issues when I was a kid. And the Mighty Samson, it might have been in Comics Journal or something. They had Frank Thorne did a four-issue series for Kimiko called Ribbit.
Yep.
I think she was a lizard or frog that they turned into a little tiny green girl.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was Comic Scene, because I remember the pages were in color they showed.
I think it was Kimiko.
Well, I mean, Comic Scene magazine had an interview. It was Kimiko. But I thought, well, this is really nice. So I bought the issues. The artwork was brilliant, the way he laid them out, especially the colors on the slick paper. You know, this is in the 80s when coloring started to improve. It was fantastic. I didn't care for the story much. I noticed everything he started doing later, he was really enamored with large breasts.
Well, he did. You know what he did, too, for War and Publications? Of course, I mentioned on every show. He did a Red Sonja knockoff called Gita.
Yeah.
And that was kind of racy, actually.
I've never seen that. There was two things. Jim Steranko's Media Scene... my buddy Britt always collected Preview Magazine and Old Media Scene. So we were at one show, and he had an issue, and it was an art issue. It had Steranko drawings. It had a Michael Kaluta House of Mystery cover of a kid flying on a giant bird. You're looking at an aerial view at all the buildings. And then it had a Frank Thorne. It said Gita. And I guess when I started hyperventilating, my friend just gave it to me. And I said, well, didn't you just buy this? I'll find another one, you know. I guess I look kind of pathetic, so thanks, Britt. But And I was looking at Gita, and I said, "What? It's Red Sonja. What says Gita here? I don't. How does he get away with that?" Well, I ended up getting some other. I think it was when Steve Gerber was suing Marvel for the rights to Howard the Duck, and it had a drawing of Gita in one of the. It was a portfolio they put out for that, and there was another drawing of Gita. I guess this time she's rolled up on the ground sleeping with a sword. And I thought, "Why, this is really nice. I'd like to see it." Well, I never did see it. I never seen it advertised. But yeah, you brought up it was close to pornography.
Yeah, pretty close, almost.
So, like I said, I always loved Frank Thorne. And the work I've seen of The Mighty Samson, it was in another magazine, I think Comics Journal, and they had a full page. I've never seen this character, but they had a full page drawing he had done.
Well, he looked like a super caveman. It was like, it looked like it was a post-apocalyptic thing, and I forgot what the storyline was, but he looked like a caveman, and he had a cape, and he was, you know, running around, and...
Yeah, the drawing had, he had like a turtle shell over one of his shoulders. I think he had an eye patch,
yeah,
and a bearskin cape or something.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
I've seen, on the internet, I've seen covers that, I guess it was Gold Key, or was it Charlton?
Gold Key.
But they had the painted covers that Gold Key usually did. I've never seen the interiors. I don't think Frank Thorne painted the covers.
No, and the ones that I have, I don't think had painted covers. I think they were like drawn covers. They may be reprints for all I know, but they were drawn covers by him.
Oh, okay. Well, like I said, I've only seen some on the internet, so I don't know them. But yeah, he's, like I said, my favorite was all of his Red Sonja work he did.
I mean, later on, for Fantagraphics, he did do The Erotic World of Frank Thorne, and that was pornography, basically. You know, those were pretty rough, actually. But yeah, I mean, you know, I guess he was he. That's what he was at. You know, I don't think he ever worked for the mainstream companies anymore after that.
I guess so. Well, maybe he was making enough money. He there was some. I ordered a couple at his comic shop. They were little black and white square bound books. One was Alex Toth, which, you know, it was a regular magazine-sized book, and the other was Frank Thorne, The Art of Frank Thorne. Most of it was fanzine work, and, you know, I had Red Sonja sketches. It had pictures of him when him and Wendy Penny did the...
I have that. It's a fanzine, right?
Yeah,
it's red,
really
cover,
nice.
Yeah.
But it's square-bound, and
yep.
He's involved in it all the way, and he has pictures. I guess there was a play he did called The Wizard and Red Sonja.
He would dress up as a wizard,
yeah,
and then
he had
do
long
conventions.
Beard.
Yeah, you know, he has a long beard and the hat, and he'd do conventions with various Red Sonjas.
So not only was he a fantastic cartoonist and designer, but he was a great wizard.
And he did some other characters for, I think, Playboy, like something...
I saw one when I was in Navy. It was a girl, like a hillbilly girl.
Yes,
yeah.
The hillbilly girl, yeah. I forgot what her name was. Beautifully drawn.
Yeah, he just never stopped. I remember in this fanzine we're talking about, there were three different women that played Red Sonja.
Yeah, there was Wendy Pini, there was, I think, another lady called Angelique, and I can't remember what the third lady was.
But I mean, they were all neat.
They were all beautiful.
But
they
had, that steel chainmail bikini.
Yeah.
And I remember in one of them, he had a little write-up, and he was talking about, I guess, Wendy and her husband, Richard Pini, who did ElfQuest. But they had brought up, I guess they made the suit themselves. And he said, "So it's official. Red Sonja steel bikini weighs," and he had the actual weight of it. He was really into it. He loved Red Sonja.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but that book put him on the map. I mean, that was a pretty popular book for Marvel back then.
It was extremely popular, and it's still, if I had to choose my favorite Frank Thorne work, it's down and out, it's that one. It's just still some of my favorite comics.
Well, there you go. More underrated artists. I'm sure we'll have more in the future, but those are the three that... Four guys that we did today. So anyway, Don, what the heck are you reading this week?
Well, I'm kind of shortchanging everybody because after the last show, Al brought up Ghost World. I'd never seen it. So Dallas took it upon himself. By the way, Dallas isn't here today because it's his first marriage anniversary. Him and his wife, it's their first year anniversary.
So let's all congratulate.
So yeah, congratulations to Dallas and Allie. You know, many more to come.
That's right.
Anyway, he took it upon himself to bring in Ghost World. He's got the trade. Daniel Klaus, the artist and writer of the book, I've seen his work. I remember the first thing I'd ever seen he'd done was Lloyd Llewellyn for Fantagraphics. I liked the cover. I bought it, so this looks kind of fun. and I did like the story. My brother just fell in love with it. He saw it. He thought it was the greatest thing ever. So I gave it to him. I went and, you know, got another one. But he was always asking me, is there any more? So every time I'd see one, and by this time I moved away, we were living in Florida, every time I'd find one, I'd, you know, buy it, read it, and put it in a manila envelope and mail it to him. My brother never holds on to anything. Whatever he gets, you know, a couple of days later, it's gone. But I think he saved every one of those. It's always been his favorite comic book. I think he's got the first issue hanging up on the wall of his studio. But Daniel Clowes always had a quirkiness. When he did 8-Ball, I'd read a couple of them, but he always had an uncomfortable dorkiness to everything he did. It's like, I don't know, whenever I read his work, it always felt like there was fingers tingling around somewhere they shouldn't be or something. So, I mean, they were always, you know, the stories were always pretty unique. I always read them, but it wasn't something I always sought out. I do think he's a great cartoonist, but it's just not a style that I cared for. It didn't hurt him any. A lot of people followed him. He just kept doing more and more work. So when Al talked about Ghost World, I thought, well, I'm sure it's quite good. But when Dallas brought it in, I read it. I love how he did the two-tone. You know, it was printed in black and it had kind of a bluish cover over it. He set that up himself, and I loved how he modeled his colors. I loved how he set the tone. I loved how he drew everything going on in the story. I like how he drew the girls, the diner, all the rooms, the buildings. It was just fantastic. I think that's my favorite work. I'm going to buy the book, even though I've already read Dallas's copy.
Buy the book, see the movie.
Well, when Al was talking about the movie, I looked this up on the internet to put it on the blog, and pictures of the movie came up, and man, I'll tell you, it looks like the girls in the comic book.
Sure does, yeah.
So, did they change much in the movie? Is it?
Well, yeah, they changed one major storyline. In the book, Enid, one of the main characters, let's put it this way. In the movie, she has a relationship with a record collector called Seymour, which is not in the book. But a lot of the little storylines that are in the book are in the movie, but the movie has that main difference. But I reread it again, and it really the movie is pretty faithful to the book as far as some of the dialogue, as far as like some of the storylines. But yeah, you really need to see the movie, and it's like I said before, it's my favorite movie adaptation of a book, of a comic book.
Yeah, well, you bought the movie.
I bought the movie, yeah, and I'll probably. I'm looking at getting a deluxe version of the book because it's got more pages in it. It's got 220 pages of extra stuff in it. And I've seen more drawings for Ghost World that weren't in the graphic novel. So I get a feeling that Daniel Clowes did some extra pages.
Yeah, the one Dallas lent me was the older one. The one I posted on the blog is a deluxe issue, so I'll probably be picking that one up.
And the thing about it too is that for me anyway, the way those characters talked, and it seemed very real to me, like I knew people like that.
There was a woman I worked with, a good friend of mine, but the main, I can't remember her name, the one with the glasses. That's exactly how this friend of mine talks. Every time I read it, I hear my friend's voice.
And
you know, the way those two girls acted was basically, I was never a girl, if anybody ever thought, but I used to do the same thing. I was always bagging on everything.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I never had anything nice to say. I guess everybody goes through that. But yeah, when he did it, it didn't seem like a guy writing a story. It seemed like real life.
The characters seemed very real. And in the movie, it's very funny, but it's also, there's a touch of sadness to it, which is also in the book, kind of like about growing up, leaving high school, and then moving on, and relationships, and all the stuff that happens, you know, losing friends, you know, all that stuff. It really rings true, and it's kind of like I told a friend of mine, this is the first movie that's come out in the 21st century that I actually like.
Well, it was my favorite part of the book was when one of the main characters was talking about going to see the cartoonist for 8-Ball.
Right? Yeah, Daniel Clowes. Yeah.
And you see, you ever seen pictures of him? Because she said she loved him. She loved the work, and she hates men. She never had it. You know, kept saying you hate guys because she was bagging on guys, never anything nice to say about them. And I said, have you ever seen him? No, but I have an idea what he'd be. And then it showed a drawing of a man that was actually really cool. You know, he's smoking.
Yeah, right.
And but he looked like kind of a really cool jazz-style 60s detective or something that had an edge to him. And then she goes in this comic store, and then she looks over, and there's this table with this single guy just sitting at the table, kind of, you know, not attractive. Look, the way he drew himself, it looked kind of creepy, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But he's got this look like, hey, I'm here. Come on, somebody come talk to me, you know, which I take my hat off. Usually when you draw yourself, you want to make yourself look really cool and awesome, and he didn't. And I thought that was funny, and then later their friend said, well, did you see him? Yeah, but I wouldn't go talk to him. He just looked so, I don't know what she described him, but that's exactly how I drew him. So I did enjoy the copy Dallas loaned me, and even though I've already read it, I want a copy for myself. This is one to have.
And after you see the movie, then we'll talk about it again.
Yeah, that's really funny. So,
yeah. I mean, it's like I said, this is the first time a movie has actually gotten me to buy a comic book. It's usually TV shows that get me to buy comic books when I was a kid. Now it's a movie that gets me to buy a comic book.
That's usually, though, like I said, we've talked before, most of the time I'm disappointed in a movie. As a matter of fact, I'm going to give a shout-out. We have one of the BOD, a bunch of dorks that we're friends with. One of them is in South Korea, and he has his own show called, forgot the name, Robot-A-Go-Go.
Slow Robot-A-Go-Go.
Oh, Slow Robot-A-Go-Go. Sorry about that. But it's a really nice show, even though I can't remember the name of it. I listen to it all the time. But he's a huge, like Al, he's a huge B-movie nut. And he reviews a movie all the time. Well, he posted a question on our Two Dimension Facebook page about what's your top five worst comic book adaption movies ever. And, you know, people were coming up making comments about only five and, you know. And, you know, he wrote again, he's wanting everybody's top five list so he could read it. Well, I'd be glad to, but, you know, and I posted on it that I'm not a fan of comic book movies. I mean, I got a few. I don't even think there's five I like. There's about five of them, or four or five that I do like, and all the rest of them I just don't like. Or either that or I haven't really seen or tried to watch part of it.
Yeah, I know. Me too. I was able to find my bottom five very easy.
Well, so, you know, I don't know. I told him one that I didn't like, but that wasn't a list. I don't know if anybody sent it. So, again, I'm sorry. I love you, man. I love your show. But
well, I gave him a list of my bottom five, but then afterwards I said my favorite one of all time is Ghost World. So there you go.
There you go. Well,
Dan Klaus, you owe us, man. We're like, you know, putting you up there along with, like, I mean, that book and the movie, the book's been compared to Catcher in the Rye. I don't know. I never read Catcher in the Rye, but I mean, you know, it is. It's, you know, that's pretty good place to be literary wise.
Well, it was the story and the art were both equally strong. Usually you read something, the story is so strong, and the art maybe doesn't always pull it off, but the art's just fantastic, the story's kind of lacking, and this and both of them are right there. So it's a nice piece. Thanks for doing it, and I'm glad it's out.
All right, well, I'm going to talk about two of books that I got from two of my favorite artists. The first one is the Reed Crandall Reader. Now, Reed Crandall was born in 1917, actually, and he started off in the Golden Age. He was working for Will Eisner Studio.
Okay.
He did he was mainly known for Black Hawk. That was his big book, but he also did Doll Man, the Ray, and other characters. And from reading about him, apparently everybody was like, you know, he was like one of the top artists from the Golden Age. Everybody loved his work. Everybody just, they said that whenever his work came into the office, everybody stopped to look at it because it was so beautiful. And it is. And it is. He later went on to work for EC, did a lot of work for EC, of course, you know, EC mentioned or whatever. And then Atlas Comics, after EC went under Atlas Comics, he did a lot of work for Marvel. He did work for Buster Brown Comics, which I have a few. They're kind of interesting.
I've never seen those.
Yeah, I have a few of them. They're just, I don't, if I remember correctly, the Crandall stories aren't like the story of Buster Brown and his dog or anything like that. It was just regular stories. He did work for Classics Illustrated. The Hunchback, I think he did.
Okay.
What did he do after that? He did work for, actually, there's a story here, a Gold Key Twilight Zone story that's inked by Frazetta, which is real nice. It's in here. What else did he do? Creepy and Eerie. Worked for them. Worked for Thunder Agents. What else? And I think Creepy and Eerie. He worked till the end of his career, like in the early 70s. But this guy's fantastic. He's a brilliant draftsman. It's like his artwork is in the style of like, I don't know, old illustrators of the early 20th century. It's like Montgomery Flagg, a little bit of Howard Pyle, N.C. Wyeth, or whatever. But he could draw the superheroes. He drew everything, you know, well. And this book is by Pure Imagination, which is Greg Teakston's company. And what Teakston does is he gets the old comics, and he, I guess he puts them in some kind of an acid, basically destroying them. But what it does is it takes the color out, and it leaves just the black and white line art. So you get like a nice, you know, reproduction of the book. And after that, he just kind of like scans it. And they're pretty much saved, you know, they pretty much look great. I mean, he's got covers here for, like, Blackhawk. He's got three or four Blackhawk stories. He's got a Mr. Hercules, Hercules superhero story.
And that Sheena I just saw.
Does he do Sheena in it? I don't think he does Sheena.
There was a woman in a leopard bikini.
Oh, well, that's always good. But yeah. This one is really interesting. He's got a story here from 1940. It's called The Old Witch. And it's from Hit Comics, but check this out, Don. In the second panel, the old witch looks like the old witch from EC Comics.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like they just like took that character and like, you know, ran with it afterwards. I don't think there's any Sheena stories in it. I don't remember. I can't remember who did Sheena. Matt Baker, maybe. I'm not sure. But the repro's beautiful. The artwork is spectacular. And, you know, every one of these Teakston books, he does books. He did a Will Eisner reader, a bunch of Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, Alex Toth. They're all worth looking and getting. Order them at the comic shop. I'm pretty sure he's got his website called pureimagination.com. This book, the art's like a 10. I mean, the stories vary. You know, I give the stories like a 5 or a 6. They all vary. But, I mean, and that Frazetta inking is wonderful. That's before Frazetta actually... That's around the time when his career, when after he did Little Abner, he started working for the comic companies, and he was taking what he could get. That was before he became, like, you know, the big shot painter and the, you know, the iconic artist that he was. So, yeah, and he's got on the back there, there's a lot of, these are for Canaveral Press, the Edgar Rice Burroughs drawings that he did. Mm. I mean, beautiful line work. Yeah, I mean, you know,
Flash
all
Gordon.
This cross-hatching and stuff like that, real classic looking, but... He did do Flash Gordon. He did Flash Gordon for Charlton Comics, actually. I forgot about that.
Yeah, John Carter, Warlord of Mars.
Yep.
And Tarzan. Yep. Yeah, yep. It's just... What I like about this book, I'm looking through it here, is how he changes.
He changes his style, yeah.
But you can tell it's him. But, some of them are real cartoony, kind of like the old Plastic Man stories. And then it goes all the way up to, like, the Flash Gordon, the Alex Raymond Flash Gordon. But he's, like I said, he's got his own way of doing things. It's...
Yeah, it goes from real cartoony to, like, real illustrative there with all the cross-hatching and all the line work or whatever. The guy was fabulous,
you know,
artist.
And what you just told me about what Greg Teakston would do was to take the colors out. I thought, if I hadn't seen the book, I thought everything would be all washed out looking.
Mm-mm.
A lot of times we try to scan things in color or even photograph things in color and get rid of the color plates and just have the black and white. Everything fades away and washes out. This looks like they just took the actual... black and white drawings, the original drawings, and scanned them in. I don't know how he did it. That's something.
I think Bill Black and AC Comics do the same things. They have their own line of reprint books.
Oh.
And I think they do the same thing. They're basically destroying the book, but they're preserving it for us. You know? So we can see a nice copy of it in black and white. You know, because they still haven't, as far as I know, they still haven't figured out how to, you know, scan a page and remove the color and like Photoshop or whatever program is, because you're always going to get the dots and you're always going to... I mean, it's probably really painstaking if you try to remove it, not to mention you'll lose a lot of the line work. But apparently with these acids that they use, it just eats up all the color, all the four colors. So it's like, you know, it comes out nice black and white, you know, pristine looking artwork. So,
well, when I read about Greg Teakston, I was in I guess 1984, 1985, he was in a Comics Interview magazine. He was a colorist.
He was a colorist,
I think he worked for DC. It was really interesting, because on the interview, he was talking about, I think he was an artist as well, but...
Oh, he is an artist. He's done covers and paintings. He did the Betty Pages books and stuff like that, yeah.
But, I mean, in the interview, they interviewed him as a cartoonist, and they did bring up, a colorist, pardon me. But they brought up other things he did, but he was really interesting, because he was showing really nice comic covers, and then explained about what got lost was the color. You know, how the colorist made everything kind of browns and grays, and the image didn't jump out at you. And he's explaining about what they should have done. I just found him extremely interesting.
Oh, yeah.
But it's something. He's still doing these kind of things and putting this together.
He was trying to do... I have a few of them, but I don't have that many of them. He was trying to do something called the Complete Jack Kirby, where he was trying to get as many of the old books that he did in the 40s and 50s and, you know, do the same thing. Texanize them, take the color out, and reprint them chronologically. Again, I only have one or two. I don't have the whole series. I'm sure that he's probably into the 50s by now, but that's like another great project that he's doing. I mean, this guy's really preserving some great old books, so he should be applauded for that. I mean, the book's $25, but it's well worth it.
Yeah,
I'd say it's
worth it.
The other one that I just got today, actually, in the mail, was the Al Williamson Archives Volume 2. Now, Al Williamson is, you know, another fantastic artist from, like, you know, the same era, from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And this is a lot of the preliminary sketches for, you know, the comic book stories and one-page illustrations or whatever. But the main thing that I get from this, and it's like, it's kind of like Art 101, it's like the preliminaries are so nice.
Yeah.
They're so well drawn at the beginning, you know, that, you know, everything that he does is great, because you can see the sketches. I mean, these are probably like, they look to me like they're almost like no penciling done on these. They're just like pen and ink, real quick sketches, but everything is done right. Everything that he's even like doing, spotting the shadows right before he does the book. So you know that everything's going to look great. And Williamson, of course, is one of the, you know, top artists of all time in comic books. So this book is another one that's well worth it. This is the second volume. It's all in black and white, and it looks to me like a lot of his preliminaries were done on tracing paper.
I was going to say, because the drawings are black and white, but they're color photographs, and it shows the yellow of the stock, and I have like three drawings on each page, and it shows them overlapping. So
yeah.
I was thinking of some, but yeah, you see, I love how they did this. This is, I've seen other Al Williamson books. I've always liked his work. But this is the one there was one they did in the 80s that a friend of mine
had.
The
Art of Al Williamson, right?
It was thick. It was covered in art. But I guess what bothered me was just so many thin lines. And after a while, it was solid drawing. But I got tired of it. This one, as soon as you opened it up, I wanted it. It's kind of thin, but it's just covered in
It's thin, but there's a lot of, there's like every page has two or three, like, you know, illustrations on it or more. Some of them are like, looks like around eight or nine little like rough sketches that he does.
Yeah, and it's not a bad one in the bunch, and it covers everything. It's got high adventure characters, science fiction characters, comics, swashbucklers, ordinary people.
Choice.
it is choice.
I think there's even a really nice, it looks pretty finished, there's a Rocketeer page into that. I don't think was ever used, and it's like, wow, I wonder why, because this thing's beautiful. Yeah, definitely, like, worthwhile getting. The first one's awesome, this one's awesome, you know, I mean, if you're a fan, you need to get this. So, the Al Williamson Archives Volume 2, another great book that I got this week, so.
Yeah, this is strong, this is really strong.
Well, Don, I guess that's it for this week, man.
This will be it. Hopefully everybody else will be here. I'm going to have a heart attack when all four of us are on the show.
Yeah, that's going to be scary. That's going to be too much, you know.
When Dallas put everything together, we all went up to Dallas's place and we met Rook, and we were just going to talk about the show and see. We didn't know how to record. And we spent 8 hours at Dallas's house talking. We could have done four shows if we knew how to record.
Yeah.
Everybody should have been there. It was great. Since then, we've never been together. So, you know, for whatever reason. One day.
It might be too intense. The four of us, it might be the comic book intensity might be too high. I don't know.
High fives all around on that day.
Yeah, it'll happen one day. It'll happen this year. So, all right, man. Well, that's all we got.
That'll be it, and we'll talk to you later.